from the City of Angels, Premier Radio Networks presents Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
Indeed, indeed, with Howard Bloom, our guest. Lots more to talk with Howard Bloom about in the next hour. We'll open up the phone lines and we'll chat with him, and you will too, on Coast to Coast AM. Howard Bloom, our guest. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. Howard, I think the phrase you were looking for when we were talking about evolutionists versus intelligent design is the new phrase.
That's
now.
It. Yep. You got it. You had an interesting question before we broke. What was it, George?
That is, first of all, do you believe in globalists who are trying to push us into a one-world government?
Well, you know, once upon a time back in the 50s and the 1960s, the idealists among us, we used to go out and protest marches. We were protesting for globalism. We were protesting for the United Nations, for more of a one-world approach to things. And as for whether I believe the dark satanic forces wearing black outfits and riding around in black helicopters are actually trying to put us all under one global government, and they're all headed by the UN in some way, no, I don't think anything as deliberate as that is happening. I think that we voluntarily, when I go online every night and I talk with people in Siberia and I talk with my friend Pavel Karakhan in Moscow, and I talk to people in South Africa and I do it all on the web, that's globalization happening right underneath our nose and there's no way of stopping it. And plus, it's heady, it's exciting as all get out to me. But there's more to your question, so to tell me more,
yes.
Do you believe in this?
Yes, I do, absolutely.
Uh-huh, okay.
Now, so we have 6 billion people on this planet.
Right.
Some will say that this planet can't sustain 6 billion people. We're
and
running out.
Some have said that. The deep ecologists have said that.
We're running out of resources. We can't feed everybody. People are starving. Globalists, they say, would like to reduce the population of this planet through some very bizarre ways. I'll talk about that in a second, to 500 million. 6 billion people down to 500 billion. And, of course, they'll be part of the 500 million. They
now,
will do
tell
it.
Tell me more about this, because I'll tell you the deep ecologist example.
Okay, they would do it by viruses.
Right.
They would do it by wars. They would do it any way they can. And some believe now that that is the reason why we're losing our rights and everything else, that this is a master plan by the Illuminati, by the one world government supporters, that one day when it happens, that's what they'd like. Now, I'm going to say something that's even when I had Alex Jones as my guest in Austin, Texas last Friday, and he was showing me some research he had done. And I believe it was Prince Philip who once said, if I could come back as anything in another life, it would be as a deadly virus so I could reduce the world's population.
That's a pretty ghastly thing.
It sure is. I believe that there are some who would like to see that happen.
Well, the only place where I found actual quotes about people wanting that to happen are from the deep ecologists and whose founding father is Arne Næss, a philosopher in Scandinavia, and his group basically says humans are destroying the planet, and humans have no right to destroy the planet, and the animals on the planet and the ecosystems on the planet must be saved, and the only way we can do that is this: there's only room for 100 million human beings on this planet. Now, and then he stops there in his argument, but what does that imply about what we do with the rest of the human beings on the planet? That means that 6 billion of us have to go. So, but that's the only one that I know of. Now, tell me some of the evidence, more of the evidence for this globalist approach.
A lot of people have talked about it. Arthur Schlesinger, Henry Kissinger, Zbigniew Brzezinski.
Right.
I mean, the list goes on and on and on of people who, I mean, they don't come out and say, we're going to release deadly viruses on you, but they talk about how they would like an orderly control to the population on this planet. Now,
well,
in retrospect, one might say, what's wrong with that?
Yeah.
Until you realize how a lot of them would like to accomplish it.
Well, you know, the people who are accused by the anti-globalists the kids who marched in the street in Seattle 4 years ago.
Yes.
The people that they're opposed to are the giant corporations and those other interests that are allied with them. And giant corporations don't want fewer people on the planet. They want more people on the planet because they want more consumers.
Well, they want people on the planet who have income to buy.
That's right.
Okay.
And an increasing proportion of people on this planet are getting the income to buy. So that plays into the hands of the Chinese, who are now capitalists. It plays into the hands of major corporations in the United States, England, and Holland, and Japan, all of which have gone global. And these people, in spending time with them, I have never run into anybody who seems to want to decrease the population. Only the Chinese have ever really gone through a very deliberate population and successful population decrease program. There's another strange thing. Let me just toss this in. It seems a little off the point. But you know that as population has increased, the number of kids families have been having have gone down.
True.
And it's not because of Planned Parenthood, much as I gave lots of money to Planned Parenthood hoping for lower population growth. It's because of something natural that, again, a cultural evolutionary process. And my friend Peter Richardson, who is one of the finest cultural evolutionists on the planet, Peter Richardson has done the arithmetic and shown that if you have a small number of kids and you put a large investment into them, that is, you put them through school, you make sure they're healthy, you do everything in your power to make sure that they have the most advantages in life they possibly can, and that they're the most productive human beings they possibly can be, then by the time you get to grandchildren and great-grandchildren, you end up with a lot more grandchildren and great-grandchildren than if you're just going around having one-night stands, getting girls pregnant, and leaving.
What happened, though, in the old days with families that would have 6, 8, 9 children in a family? And they stem from hardworking couples, maybe blue-collar workers, but these guys were out there and they made a living, they took care of their family, the woman stayed home. But they didn't have one or two kids, Howard. They had lots of kids. And you couldn't call them poor people.
Right.
They weren't economically deprived and they weren't socially deprived.
Right.
They just wanted to have big families. They all had big families in those days.
Well, that's changed now. The major change in Western society along those lines came in the 1800s. Even in Charles Darwin's day, you could count on roughly half your children dying because we didn't have antibiotics, we didn't have modern medicine, and the death rate among those under the age of 5 and even those under the age of 15 was hideously high.
So if you wanted 2, you had 4, huh?
Yes, exactly. And that meant Darwin, I believe, had 6. But then as medicine kicked in. In actuality, antibiotics didn't kick in until 1948. They didn't become a major commercial product available to everybody until 1948. Once antibiotics kicked in and the antibiotic revolution took hold, then we had the luxury of just having 2-kid families and 3-kid families.
Well, see, I see nothing wrong with families controlling growth. That,
right.
That, I think, is smart.
Right.
But what bothers me is this systematic plan to one day eradicate everybody.
Well,
except for them.
I would find just as horrible as you would. And any evidence for that, by all means, have it forwarded to me. I know that at one point, Lisa Lyons, one of your producers, who is a wonderful person, and
yes,
I have a terrific time with, as you probably know, Lisa said, well, why don't we set you up for a debate with Alex Jones? And it would be interesting, but of course, Alex knows his stuff.
Alex would be all over you. He's a bulldog, Howard.
He's a bulldog, and he really has it down to the last detail in areas that I haven't studied. So you know, I hope you know, or at least I try to think that I'm reasonably good in the areas of my expertise, which tend to be fairly all over the place.
Well, yeah.
They're deliberately very widespread. That's what omnology is all about. But they're limited. And I think that the things that Alex knows and the facts that he's been keeping track of are very different than the facts that I've been keeping track of.
I'm not so sure you should be in a debate with Alex. I think you should be more of the commentator with Alex. I think you should react to some of the things he says.
Well, that would be very interesting.
Rather than debating, because I wouldn't put you in a ring with a boxer that I knew could punch you out.
Right.
Alex could punch you out.
Oh, I know that.
So I don't think we should do that to you.
But commentary would be very interesting.
Yes.
Because in a sense, here's another aspect of cultural evolution. You know how an insect has a compound eye?
Yeah.
And it'll have like 160 different little panes in its eye,
mm-hmm.
and 160 different little pictures that it's putting together.
So if it were looking at you, there'd be 100 Howards that
right.
he'd say.
Okay. Well, one of the benefits of human society is that one of the benefits of creative bickering, that is that we all pick our own little territory, and it's a little different from everybody else's territory, is that when we're in a group of 100 people, we operate like a compound eye. And Alex will dwell on one facet of society that's very, very worth diving into, but takes a great deal of individual time and effort. And I will dive into other facets of human society, and you will dive into yet other facets
mm-hmm.
of human society. And by the time we're finished, if we put our knowledge together, if we stop our bickering every once in a while and look at the grand overview, between us, we are patching together pieces of this jigsaw puzzle world.
Why don't I get Alex, David Icke, and you on a show, and
that would be really, really neat, because as I said, these
yeah.
guys are paying attention to areas that I'm ignorant about.
I would do that.
And I love learning new things.
I would do. Now, back to the globalist question.
Right.
Do you believe it's possible, then, that there's a group of people out there who are controlling a lot of things, and we'll save a lot of that for another program, but that they would like to see the population reduced to 500 million for their own purposes? Do you think it's possible?
Anything is possible. Remember, science is all about skepticism. And science says that anything that we, any belief system that we have at the moment is provisional. That means this is our best picture of at the moment of what our world is all about. And we may find out some very strange things tomorrow, the day after tomorrow, or next year. So anything is possible. I'm just curious, you know, there's been a lot of fuss made on the left about the various documents that were floated for a new world order. And those documents made a lot of sense to me, because you know that back when we were talking about the Iraq War at the very beginning,
yes,
and you were asking me whether I felt we should be making war
mm-hmm.
in Iraq, I was trying to explain that nuclear weapons were about to go retail. They were about to get into the hands of all kinds of people who don't have the same sort of beliefs that the Russians and the Americans had back in the days when things were relatively sane.
Yeah, I think you're right, too.
And those people believe that, to use a quote that I used back then, that this planet is but a cinder in the eye of God, which means as far as they're concerned, the whole planet can be snuffed, and who cares? God's going to take care of the good people, and he's going to punish the bad people one way or the other. It's all about eternity. Well, when you put nuclear warheads into the hands, and I'm talking warheads, because all of the weapons that are being distributed these days, the nuclear weapons, and all of the plans for making your own nuclear weapons, are no longer for great big atomic bombs like the ones that nearly filled the belly of a cargo plane back in World War II. They're for 36-inch diameter nuclear weapons that are specifically designed to be put on missiles, and almost everybody's got missiles these days. At any rate, we were talking about the fact that we're at a point where civilization could disappear entirely. And as a consequence, perhaps we had to go to war somewhere in order to stop the kind of cocky arrogance that folks like Osama bin Laden were beginning to get over victories like the victory at the World Trade Center. And we had to establish a Pax Americana, like the Pax Britannica or the Pax Romana.
Mm-hmm.
Back in the days of Pax Romana, you could go all the way from Britain. There's a kid over in Britain who basically got a message from his dad. His dad was in Asia Minor. That's thousands of miles away. He got a message that his dad needed him. He jumped on a horse, and there were posts. You know that there were paved highways back in the days of the Roman Empire that spanned the entire empire. And every 40 miles on those highways, most people don't know this, there were post houses. Those post houses kept fresh horses, just like the Pony Express. So that if you wanted to get someplace fast, every 40 miles, you stopped, you changed horses, you went the next 40 miles. When that horse was worn out, you changed for another horse. This guy was over in Asia Minor from England so fast that it was ridiculous. And his name was Constantine. and the city of Constantinople,
yep.
which later became Byzantium, the city we were talking about before,
exactly.
was named after him. So at any rate, that was the Pax Romana. Then in 1816 or 1814, the British defeated Napoleon. And the result was the Pax Britannica. And that meant roughly 70 years or more of peace. In fact, when it came to world wars, it led to 100 years of peace. And those 100 years of peace were glorious. And the Cold War is one of the longest unheralded pieces we've ever had. It was a period of incredible stability, despite all the minor things and horrible things that were going on during that period of time. Well, we will be supremely blessed if we are able to achieve a Pax Americana. And I'm not saying that the war in Iraq is the solution to that problem. It's produced more headaches than it's, or more problems than it's solved. Although, again, looking at CNN yesterday and today and talking about culture swinging back and forth like a pendulum, one of the things that keeps culture swinging back and forth like a pendulum is that humans are eternally bored. They get bored very easily.
True.
So on Sunday, all of the news on CNN was about the triumph of the elections in Iraq. All of Tuesday's news was Michael Jackson. Now, we have to see if the triumph of that election, which was really remarkable, went against everybody's expectations, that is, in terms of the turnout. We have to see if that results in anything substantive. We don't know if it will.
Well, probably will take years.
Right. I'm sure it will take years. That's another thing. When people talk about exit strategies, they're talking about suicide strategies. Because you don't do anything worthwhile in just a year and a half or a quarterly cycle.
No, whether you agree with this war or not, our troops, unfortunately or fortunately, are there to stay for
a
long time.
And we're there to stay, too. We have a long-term commitment.
Condoleezza Rice says they're not leaving until the Iraqis can take over and defend themselves, and that's not going to happen for a long
well,
time.
Well, to switch, basically to finish up on the Pax Americana thought, yes, I agreed with the folks who wrote out the plans for a new world order. Not because it was some sort of global order that was going to determine that you and I should die, but because we need a new form of peace, and peace only comes when there is a dominant force, a single dominant force, like Rome or like Britain, that is able to keep everybody else quiet.
So you would support that?
Yes, I would support that, absolutely.
As long as you were one of the New World Order board of directors, I bet.
Well, not exactly. I'm perfectly happy to have things go the American way. Because, look, we're fairly benevolent when it comes to other cultures. Yes, we may put McDonald's in their culture, but that doesn't mean that the Italians stop eating spaghetti. And, yes, we eat pizza. That doesn't mean that the Romans have conquered New York City.
It's sort of like a Star Trek federation of planets, almost?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So we tend to be pretty benevolent. And, yes, we do cherish other cultural contributions. That's why we do have pizza parlors all over the place. But the alternative to that, if the alternative to that is a Mad Max wasteland, which is exactly what will happen if those weapons that are right now, those nuclear weapons that are right now going retail, get into the wrong hands, and they are going into the wrong hands.
There's no
George
question
Welch
about
would want them.
No question about it. Hey, I want to talk with you about something when we come back from the break. You said something interesting. When I first talked to you several years ago, you said you were an atheist, right? You have used in tonight's show, in a forward-thinking manner, the word God three times.
Aha!
I need to
maybe it's the Nuri influence.
I need to find out why.
Right.
Good. For someone who's an atheist, how could you evoke the name of God three times?
That's a good question.
Yep. You think about that when we come back. Howard Bloom is two books out. By the way, he is, those of you who are fast-blasting me, yep, he's the author of the book called The Lucifer Principle, which is a scientific expedition into the forces of history. And he's written the book Global Brain as well. His website, howardbloom.net, not .com, howardbloom.net. My website, of course, coasttocoastam.com, our website as well. And if you need to also get to it, it's georgenori.com. It'll take you straight to it. Pretty neat, huh? Back in a moment.
Thank you.
Get it in writing with the After Dark newsletter. Subscribe by calling 1-888-727-5505.
People are strange when you're a stranger. Faces look ugly when you're alone. Women seem wicked when you're unwanted. Streets are an evil home when you're down, when you're strange. Faces come out of the rain when you're strange. No one remembers your name when you're strange. When you're strange, when you're strange.
You're listening to Coast AM with George Norrie.
With our special guest, Howard Bloom. I'm going to take some fast blast questions next, and also we'll talk with Howard about his thoughts of being an atheist and how now he just keeps using the name God all the time in a very positive way, by the way. Filament Book Club is available to you when you go online at Filament, F-I-L-A-M-E-N-T, bookclub.com, where they'll give you a free electronic book. As a matter of fact, when I was in Austin, Texas this weekend signing, someone came up and showed me her ebook. She was all excited, and it's a neat-looking machine. So you can go to the web, get it for free when you become a member of their book club, okay? So it's filamentbookclub.com or this toll-free number, 1-888-95-E-BOOK. That's 1-888-95-E-BOOK. Well, Howard, as we get into this big question of you being an atheist several years ago, and I want to know how come you're mentioning God, somebody wanted to know if you were the Antichrist.
I'm one of my favorites. That's a good one.
I don't think you are.
That's an elevation, and I'm not sure whether that's an elevation in rank or I've just been given a de-promotion.
I don't know. All right. You said you were an atheist a couple
right.
of years ago, and you and I kind of did a little toe-to-toe about that.
Right.
And now you talk about God in some of your phrases, some of your structured thought. How
well,
come?
Okay, let me try to explain it. I'm still an atheist.
And are you aware you're doing that?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Very aware.
All right.
Very aware. But I'm still an atheist. But there's something called isomorphic symbol sets. And when I'm trying to describe to people the relationship between the arts and the sciences, I say there are three isomorphic symbol sets: religion, the arts and poetry, and science. In other words, all of these are different languages or different ways of trying to get at the same thing. And I am absolutely staggered with awe by the fact that if the evolutionary view of life is correct, that we live in a universe that could go from nothing to a big bang in an instant, so much less than an instant that we can't even measure it. I am absolutely awed by the fact that we can go from an expanding manifold of space-time that shoots out at a speed way beyond our imagining to the precipitation of particles, and particles that are so identical to each other that there are 10 with 81 zeros after them. A figure much bigger than the zillions of identical protons precipitating out of this expanding sheet of nothing but space and time all at once. I'm astounded that those things can coagulate in galaxies 300,000 to a million years later. I am astounded that those galaxies can then begin to compress their matter and that matter can catch fire and give off something new called light. let there be light. Indeed, there was a moment of let there be light in this universe, one way or the other. And I'm astounded by life. I am astounded by the fact that on this lonely little planet, this piece of rock, 4 billion years ago, that was naked 4 billion years ago, naked and being smacked by planetesimals as if it were the face of a boxer, and totally deformed by these huge meteorites, massive meteorites, one of them, in fact, a planet, the planet that tore off the moon. I'm astonished that these new molecular teams could get together and actually be clever enough to not only survive in their environment, but then to reproduce themselves. And they didn't do it alone. They did it in teamwork with a cellular wall. There is no such thing as DNA just reproducing on its own. It does it inside of a cell. So from the very beginning of life, there were apparently cells working in collaboration with DNA inside of them. That is an astonishment. How dare molecules attempt such a thing? And I'm astonished by the fact that for 3.5 billion years, this stuff that I call biomass, and a lot of people do, but this stuff that's DNA and cell-oriented, this stuff we call life, has been on this rapidly imperialistic process of taking over as many of the inorganic molecules, as many of the inanimate molecules as possible, and turning them into yet more life.
Well, welcome to the club, Howard.
So it's amazing, George, and a universe that can produce that many surprises in 13.7 billion years, think what it's going to produce over the next 13.7 billion
years. Well, did you think this way 2.5 years ago when we first talked?
Oh, yes, I always have. George,
then you were holding back.
I was holding back because way back at the very beginning of my scientific life, you know, I was 10 when I got into science. I was 13 by the time I realized I was an atheist. And you know that the two principles in science that had really grabbed my soul were the truth at any price, including the price of your life, and look at things right under your nose as if you've never seen them before, and then ask all of the questions that come from the wonder and awe that ensues when you see them as if you never saw them before, as if you've seen them anew. Well, the thing that I realized was right under my nose was God. The thing that I realized was right under my nose was the perpetual belief in God, the fact that everybody I knew believed in God. Everybody I knew believed in one form or another of heaven and hell. Every society or tribe that I had ever studied, and remember, at 13, I didn't have a social life, so what else could I do but study?
That's true. Boy wonder.
Books.
Yeah.
So every tribe that I knew of had the same beliefs. And so it seemed to me the most obvious thing was not to look under my nose for something that everybody else was overlooking, but to look behind my nose. And there I would find the belief in religion. And why did I go out on an expedition to find the gods inside of us? Because one of the most impressive things about the belief in God and the belief in religion was the passion that went into it. And the passion was often overwhelming. I mean, phrases like the Passion of Christ are not accidental phrases. They refer to a kind of being in touch with, you know, I have no scientific word for this. They mean being in touch with a kind of divinity. And as a scientist, it's my responsibility to come up with a different way of looking at it and come to say what divinity means. But there is divinity inside of you. There's divinity inside of me. There's divinity inside of a stone simply for being, when once upon a time there was no being whatsoever. There's divinity in some strange way inside of almost everything, but mostly it's inside of us human beings.
If you had a chance to get into a time machine and go back to a certain period of this planet, where would you go?
Oh, my God. First of all, I'd never survive the health problems of the pre-antibiotic age, so that limits me to 1948. But, you know, I would really suspect that I would go back to the time of Jesus.
You would?
It is...
To witness? To ask?
Yes, I would want to hear what he was saying. I would want to be there at the Sermon on the Mount. I would want to see what was interpreted as the loaves and fishes. I would want to be able to talk to St. Paul, who was an astonishing person. I mean, if nothing else, he was one of the greatest public relations artists in the history of the planet. He took a religion, reshaped it, and then found a way to take it right across the boundaries of every kind of culture that existed within the Roman Empire. I would want to know these people. And you know something? I think that if I were to sit down with, and this may sound sacrilegious, But if I were to sit down and talk to Jesus, I would be utterly fascinated by him.
I'm sure you would. Now, what would you say to Judas?
Oh, my God. This is just a personal, ethical, moral matter. And as a personal, ethical, moral being, I do not believe in betraying somebody that you should be loyal to by any stretch of the imagination. And I would be furious. I would be absolutely furious, but I would also be furious with the Romans, because the Romans had this nasty habit called crucifixion. And, back during the slave rebellions of Spartacus, when the Romans finally defeated Spartacus' armies, do you know what they did? Well, I shouldn't be asking you all these questions because I've been giving you these history quizzes all night long. But again, when that war was over, and it was a difficult war to win, Spartacus' slave troops were incredibly good militarily. But, they were former gladiators. When it was all over, just to show that the slaves must never, ever, ever, ever rebel again, the Roman emperor had 6,000 of those slave rebels crucified, and he put every single one of those crucifixes, like a Burma Shave sign, like a poster, next to the major roadway.
All the way down.
That's right, yeah. All the way down the Appian Way, from one town to another.
That's all you could see if you were coming down that road.
Right, and what a hideous advertisement.
Yeah.
How could anybody, if what Judas was doing was going to lead to this kind of barbarity, and it was, even if it was only to one man, and it wasn't, because remember, this was a mass crucifixion. There were two thieves next to Jesus, and they were just part of the group. Then how could I ever support that in a million years, George?
Would you try to save him?
You're not kidding. Yes, absolutely. I would risk my life to save him. If it meant dying for him, I would have died for him. Not because I'm a Christian, but because no decent human being on this planet should ever, ever, ever be treated that way. Not ever. Not with nuclear weapons, not with nails and boards, not with any weapon available to mankind. Not now, not in the future, and certainly not in the past.
And I guess if you got back in that time machine and came back to this era, you'd realize if you were successful or not.
Well, I'd realize if I were successful or not, or I might not make it back to this era, because there are certain things I just won't tolerate. You know, the basic, to me, I think to you, the basic rule is we want a just universe. We want a good universe. And that means that if we see something evil happening around us, if we see something terrible being done to another human being, we will stop on our tracks and risk our lives to stop it. Because if we walk by and let it happen, knowing that we could have stopped it, we will know that we have become not a part of the force, but a part of the anti-force. Not a part of whatever is heavenly and divine, but a part of whatever is hideous and malignant.
Do you believe that there are people who can predict the future?
Well, people in science, science is about prediction and control, work their tails off to predict the future. And in our lifetime, in fact, in the last 10 years, one of our prediction mechanisms, which is weather forecasting, has gone from abysmal to being almost entirely on target. So we've made massive strides in prediction just during the last 10 years. And certainly, that I, back in the 1980s, was trying to get all of my editor and producer friends, television producer friends, to cover the black-on-black violence in Central and North Africa. And not a single one of them would touch it. And there were two tribes that I was trying to get them to cover before it turned into genocide. And those two tribes were the Hutus and the Tutsis. So by normal means, not supernatural. And you know what happened with the Hutus and the Tutsis. Eventually a million people ended up being killed. And if my friends who were producers and journalists had covered it in the 1980s when there was a chance to stop it, it wouldn't have happened. It wouldn't have happened. So there are ways of predicting things without being supernatural. But when it comes to supernatural ways of predicting things, well, as a professional skeptic and as a science-oriented person and a scientist, I have to really take a look at any evidence that I'm given about somebody predicting something in the future, look at it seriously, but also look at it very critically, and then try to determine if there are ways to explain it by other means.
Interesting. You've come a long way, Howard Bloom.
Well, I've come to confess some things I wasn't as willing to confess. One of your tremendous fans is a friend of mine and is involved in helping me a great deal these days. Lisa DeCrescenti, and she comes over here often, and she says, Howard, you're not an atheist.
No,
you, that's not like George Norrie talking.
No, you may be agnostic, which is basically prove it, but I don't think you're an atheist.
Well, I'm probably a pantheist, because, George, I do believe that if, you know, we talked about the dream of peace and how we humans are alone, we've been the only species capable of dreaming of peace. And if we're ever going to make that dream come true, it's going to depend on me and you. It's going to depend on me, you, Alex Jones, and everybody else we know working our tails off. Because there's nothing here but us little tiny people. And even if one believes in God, it has been told us many a time about God, that God helps he who helps himself.
See, I think in the long run, even if they try to do what they'd like to do, that we win out. I mean, I am a strong believer in that.
Now, how so? Because
that's just my gut tells me that.
Their God tells them the opposite. Their God tells them that if they win out, they win out. Because it's always been, this world should have always, no matter what the other God system is that we're talking about that's opposing ours.
Is it their God or their devil, Howard?
Well, their God is what they, their devil is what they say possesses us. If you look at the Lucifer Principle, my first book, it'll show you how every society that's wanted to demonize another society has said they're demons, has said that they're some sort of instantiations of Satan, of some sort of demonic force. And that is a way of riling your society up and getting it motivated to trounce the other society. Well, you know that the great battle between civilizations today is between Islam and the West. Now, that doesn't mean all Muslims, but the small number of Muslims who are into this in a really militant way say that you Westerners are corrupt. You Westerners are filled with sin. You Westerners turn your women into prostitutes.
You don't deserve to live.
You don't deserve to live, exactly. And it also says in their doctrine that those who don't actually drop everything that they're doing and go out and make war with you and try to kill you, they're not going to make it into paradise. They're going to make it into hell. And hell is something so vicious that it's appalling. In hell, you are roasted so consistently that you scream as your skin crisps and falls off. And then, because God wants you to feel even more pain, he puts another skin on you so you can feel that pain all over again. So hell is not exactly where you want to go. And in the militant Islamic view of things, if you don't actually get out there and fight and kill other human beings on behalf of returning, of liberating all societies on this planet so they can see the true light of God, meaning Allah, then you aren't going to make it into paradise. We're talking about people who are deep believers. We are talking about people who are passionate idealists. We are talking about people whose idealism is as great as yours and mine, and you and I are both idealists. Unfortunately, their God is our Satan, and our God is their Satan.
In their minds.
In their minds.
Yeah.
Right. And that's the way humanity's always been. Can we take it beyond this stage? If you and I don't work our tails off to make it happen so we can take it beyond this stage, I will be severely disappointed in the two of us.
Maybe one day some extraterrestrials will come down and save all of us.
That would be nice, but until then, I think it's up to you and me, and it's up to the people in this audience. It is up to us. I mean, if we think that there are people who are trying to become one-worlders and take over the entire planet, it's up to us to resist them.
It'll be a bumpy road.
If they do take over this entire planet, they're going to have these Islamic militants to contend with, just like they're going to have you and me to contend with. They're going to have a very difficult time. Bumpy road indeed.
If you had the ability to change anything on this planet right now, one thing, what would it be?
Well, you know, it really would be. I know that every single girl who's a beauty contestant model, pageant contestant, always says this, but it would be world peace.
They all do say that, don't they?
Yes, and it would be world peace. Because, look, when we learned a major lesson, we should have learned a major lesson.
As long as there's greed, there'll never be world peace. You know that.
No, that's not true. I mean, once upon a time, we defeated a country that wanted to have an empire, and that country was called Japan. And that country was a master of military discipline. A cousin of mine who was in the Air Force fighting the Japanese back during World War II said fighting those pilots was almost impossible because these guys had been dunked in freezing water over and over and over again just to teach them to survive. They had been thrown through every torture that we in North America would never imagine putting our troops through just to teach them how to survive. These guys were... they were the rabid mongrels of the sky, and yet they were skilled as could possibly be. Well, we won that war against the Japanese, and we've been competing with the Japanese. It's not exactly as if war has stopped. The violence has stopped. The competition has continued, and the competition has been in the economic realm. And thanks to that competition, we now have Walkmen. We now have cell phones. We now have all kinds of micro-miniaturized gadgetry. When competition stops being violent and becomes economic, it becomes creative, and it adds to our force as human beings, all of us. It adds to all of us. In Afghanistan, when we finally won the Afghan War, came as close to winning it as you can, what do you think became I don't want to put you on the spot again, but the most popular item in Afghanistan became, of all things, cell phones.
Well, and yeah, second to opium.
Well, the opium they sell more than they use. But cell phones became the dominant item. And why? Because a village could now simply get a cell phone and suddenly be in touch with the rest of the world. If it weren't for that competition between Japan and the rest of the West over the course of the last 50 years, we wouldn't have those cell phones.
By the way, when we come back, we'll open up the phones for you, Howard. And a fellow by the name of Howard Bloom in Havertown, Pennsylvania, writes to say hi. There's two of you. We'll be back in a moment.
Find out more about tonight's guest. Log on to coasttocoastam.com.